Sorry for the delay, counsel. The passion with the previous argument had us all wrapped up. This is Jessica Williams versus State of Nevada, case number 66579. Mr. Pichetta, how are you?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Michael Pichetta. I represent Ms. Williams in this case. If I may, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. I'll keep an eye on the time. But I think this is a very simple case. It's before the court on the fast track statements, but I think they show our arguments and the state's arguments adequately, because our argument is very simple. We could write it on a postcard. At the time that Ms. Williams committed the acts that led to her convictions, there were two statutes that covered marijuana metabolite. One, NRS 484.379, said marijuana metabolite is a prohibited substance. One, 484.1245, said marijuana metabolite is not a prohibited substance. That is really the sum total of our argument under the state and federal due process clauses. All of the statutory construction principles that might be imagined to harmonize these statutes, the analysis that was performed in Williams 2, the appeal from the grant of habeas relief, are irrelevant, because the legislative intent is not what we are examining here. What we are examining is whether, under the Due Process Clause, a person of ordinary intelligence, not a law professor with Sutherland on statutory construction at his or her elbow, but a person of ordinary intelligence would make of what is and isn't prohibited, where the theory on which she was convicted said either you're guilty or you're not guilty. It's not just a question of notice to the defendant, though that's the primary focus of the vagueness, the constitutional vagueness prohibition. In some ways, more importantly, it's to provide standards for police, for prosecutors, for courts, for juries, to say, how are we going to administer the statute?
Mr. Pichetta, notwithstanding the postcard version of your argument, how do we get past the procedural bars?
I think that's the easier question, Your Honor. Mr. Watkins, who was trial counsel and appellate counsel and initial post-conviction counsel and ultimately federal counsel, didn't raise this vagueness claim. As he testified without contradiction, he didn't know. He didn't know that it existed. And in fact, he found out about NRS 484.1245 at the time after the trial at a CLA that he and Mr. Nelson were given. And Mr. Nelson mentioned that this was, that there was this other provision, the schedule provision, that said marijuana metabolite doesn't qualify as a prohibited substance. And so when he raised this, finally on appeal, in the appeal from the grant of relief by the state, he said, I had no tactical or strategic reason for raising this, and if I should have raised it, I was ineffective. And he testified without contradiction at the habeas and at the proceeding in front of Judge Leavitt in this matter, that he had no tactical or strategic reason. So this turns on whether, substantively, this constitutional issue is or is not valid, because due to the conflict of interest arising from him having to litigate his own ineffectiveness in order to get this vagueness issue before the court, he had a conflict which infected any of his representation on collateral and direct appeal, until unconflicted counsel, and that would be our office, was appointed instead of him by Judge Dawson. We have cited a slew of unpublished orders that say, and nobody has said that they don't say what we say they say, which is that this court has acted sua sponte in most cases, but on objection in other cases, to provide another habeas remedy when there is a question of ineffective assistance of counsel that has not been raised by appointed counsel due to his or her own ineffective assistance. Those cases remain unpublished, but they are relevant for this court's consideration as an equal protection matter, because if the litigants in those cases got a new habeas based on this conflict, Ms. Williams is in precisely the same posture. Now, the only one of those cases that is really addressed in the state's fast-track response is Moran, and I'm very familiar with Moran. And what Moran says is that in an untimely and successive habeas petition, Mr. Moran was procedurally barred, not because this conflict was not a theory on which he could overcome the procedural bars, but on the ground that he had unconflicted counsel through many years of that representation toward the end. And that's in Volume 3 of the appendix at 484, 485, footnote 3. In all of these other cases, including a case like Wade, where this court was reviewing an appeal from a denial of habeas relief, the court sua sponte said, well, we're affirming the denial of habeas relief in this case, but we see from the record that appointed counsel in this proceeding was in the position of having to raise his own ineffectiveness, and therefore we are remanding for the district court to appoint new counsel and conduct another habeas hearing. If this court would do that for Mr. Wade, why not for Ms. Williams, where counsel in the post-conviction appeal by the state said, if I didn't raise this, and I should have, it's my ineffectiveness. And this court didn't address it in the post-conviction appeal. And it did not intervene to say, and that's the reason we should remove you and send this back to the district court for another hearing. So that is an open question at this point, and by reference to the other practices of this court in the unpublished opinions that we have cited and which have not been contradicted by the state, Ms. Williams is entitled to a conflict-free habeas proceeding, and that's what's before you now. And in fact, that's what Judge Leavitt agreed with in this proceeding. She agreed that we could overcome the procedural defaults based on these other unpublished dispositions as a matter of equal protection of the laws and treatment of similarly situated individuals similarly. But we lost on the merits. And that's why the merits are properly before this court. And I submit, if this court were to say, well, this rule does not apply to Ms. Williams, despite the fact that we have applied it in all of these other cases over the years, then we are talking about yet another equal protection problem in this case. And I think that means that this court really needs to address the merits of the case, which it has not addressed before. Because in the previous direct appeal and in the post-conviction appeal, this vagueness issue was not determined. This court said, yes, initially over different due process arguments on the direct appeal, that this was constitutional. But that argument didn't take account of NRS 484.1245 because counsel wasn't aware of it at the time. When it was raised on the post-conviction appeal, this court said, well, 484.379 is clear. It says marijuana metabolite is a prohibited substance. And that's that. without considering the vagueness problem of we aren't talking about 484.379 itself. We're talking about what is the effect of having two statutes saying, one, that this is a prohibited substance, and one saying this is not a prohibited substance. That's the bottom line here. Would any person of ordinary intelligence looking at the statutory scheme be able to say, yes, this one controls or that one controls? If this had been a less difficult case as a matter of fact, if this had not been so publicly terrible and notorious a case, possibly the district attorney's office would have looked at 484.1245 and would have said we have to go back to the legislature because we have got two different definitions of whether marijuana metabolite is or is not a prohibited substance. But that's the problem with the standardlessness of this statutory scheme, is that it puts elected officials in the position of saying, well, but we can't do that because the public outrage on this will mean the district attorney will never get elected again. That's why both for juries and for trial court judges and for prosecutors, there needed to be, at the time this offense occurred, a clear answer to the question, which of these statutes, which are equally the law, which were adopted in 1999 in the same chapter of the NRS, two sections away from each other, why does this one control and not that one? At best, this situation is at best a tie. And as Justice Scalia said once, pithily in a rule of lenity case, ties go to the defendant in our system of justice. The state has to bear the burden of showing that the statute under which the defendant was convicted clearly prohibited this particular action. We cited Bowie versus City of Columbia. That has never been overruled. The state has not discussed it in the fast track response. But that is a case in which the South Carolina courts took the position that trespassing included remaining in a place where somebody had been told to leave. It was a lunch counter sit-in case from 1960. And the South Carolina court said, well, yes, it does, although they had never adopted that in that interpretation before. And the United States Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. You can't expand the statute to cover this conduct because that violates the due process guarantee of notice. Here, we have the same thing essentially in reverse. We have two mutually exclusive definitions of marijuana metabolite as it relates to being a prohibited substance. Ms. Williams has been in prison for 16 years despite one of those provisions which says it's not a prohibited substance. And that's why this court needs to reverse the denial of habeas relief. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time if I might.
All right, Mr. Mishita. Mr. Nelson.
Good morning, Justices. Bruce Nelson appearing on behalf of the state of Nevada. In 2002, this court ruled that the prohibited substance statute was not vague. In 2004, this court again ruled that the prohibited statute relating specifically to marijuana metabolites was not vague. Now we're here in 2016 with exactly the same argument. Well, what has changed? Nothing. The law is still the same. The case law is still the same. There's absolutely nothing new in this case. Now, the defense is making two arguments here, but they're really only making one, because their first argument to get around all the procedural bars basically begs the question. They say that the one thing that gets us around the procedural bars is that Watkins was ineffective. Well, in 2004, although it was not directly addressed by the 2004 Williams decision, this court determined as a matter of law that Watkins was not ineffective. Because his ineffectiveness argument was, I didn't raise this metabolite issue in the lower court. This court held in 2004 that the metabolite issue he was seeking to raise was not valid. Therefore, you can't be ineffective for failing to raise an invalid argument. Ironically, that was decided yesterday by this court in State versus Lewis, 66985, where Lewis argued, my counsel was ineffective for failing to interview these witnesses and presenting them at court. The trial court held these witnesses would not have been allowed to testify had they been brought to court. This court concluded, therefore, counsel was not ineffective for failing to do something that wouldn't have mattered anyway. That's what we have here. Well, if he's not ineffective, then by definition, all the procedural bars do apply, and the lower court erred in not dismissing this case outright based upon those procedural bars. The court did find, based upon this court's repeated rulings, that the statute is not vague, and it is not vague. The only thing the defense has been able to cite in opposition to that is a case out of Arizona, Montgomery, but it is easily distinguishable from our case. The main difference is that Montgomery recognized that in Arizona we now have medical marijuana, therefore it's not fair to criminalize metabolites. But when Jessica Williams chose to smoke marijuana, drive a car, and as a result kill six people, there was no medical marijuana in the state of Nevada. Even today, medical marijuana does not provide a defense to any DUI charge. The medical marijuana statute, 453A300 specifically, says that medical marijuana is not a defense to driving under the influence, nor is it a defense to any other conduct prohibited by the DUI statute. Well, the only other conduct prohibited is the metabolite, the per se violations for having a drug or its metabolite in your system. Secondly, Nevada recognizes urine testing, and I'm not engaging in hyperbole when I say if the metabolite section is thrown out, every impaired driver impaired by marijuana in the state of Nevada will escape conviction by the simple expedience of requesting a urine test, because marijuana does not appear in urine, only metabolites do. So someone could request that test and then very successfully argue, there's no evidence I was under the influence of marijuana. You found no marijuana in my bodily fluid. Much more on point, I would submit, is the case of State versus Whalen, 991 NE 2nd, 378, out of Ohio. Ohio has a statute similar to ours that says if you have marijuana metabolites in a certain amount in your blood or urine, you're guilty. The argument in Whalen was the statute was vague and ambiguous and so on. The court determined a person of ordinary intelligence is certainly capable of understanding the meaning of a marijuana metabolite, and that driving with prescribed levels of such a metabolite in one's system is to be prohibited. I would also refer the court to State versus Toplowski, which was an unpublished Ohio decision, December 1st, 2015, number 4963, that distinguished the Montgomery case by noting that because Ohio sets levels and Arizona did not, that is a key distinction between the two statutes. The Arizona decision was very odd because the court said, well, it's not fair to punish somebody if there's no evidence that they were impaired. The court then went on to know, we have a .08 law that says if you're .08 or above within 2 hours of driving, you're guilty regardless of impairment. Why is it valid to have a .08 law that doesn't require proof of impairment, Arizona Supreme Court, but invalid to say that of marijuana metabolites? Our metabolite statute actually has two metabolites that are non-impairing. One is marijuana, and the other one is the cocaine metabolite, benzolicanine. It is also non-impairing, but if you drive under the influence of that either cocaine, or if you have the prohibited amount of cocaine or the metabolite in your system, you are guilty. Therefore, our statute is fundamentally different than what is in Arizona. We're much more akin to Ohio. I think the two cases that address the point directly on point were Lugman out of this court and Walton out of the federal court. Lugman was a case where the legislature said we're repealing the old Controlled Substance Act and enacting a new one. But before the new one took effect, Lugman got arrested for possession of controlled substances, and he said, hey, wait a minute, you repealed the old one, the new one doesn't exist yet, therefore there is no crime. This court determined, no, that the legislative intent, which controls above everything, was clearly to have a Controlled Substance Act, therefore, Mr. Lugman, you are guilty. United States versus Walton, Congress passed a law that said it's illegal to possess any form of cannabis sativa, marijuana. Walton came to court and said, well, wait a minute, I don't have cannabis sativa. I have cannabis indicia, a different form of marijuana. Therefore, I can't be convicted. Well, the federal court said Congress clearly intended to ban all forms of marijuana, even though they may have used some inartful language. Therefore, Mr. Walton, you are guilty, a position that incidentally has been followed by every other federal court of appeals. And I'd like to close my comments with a small quote from Walton, which I think, if it would modify to this case, would be directly on point. Walton noted with regard to the marijuana, while Congress, with the wisdom of hindsight, could have been more clear in its definition of marijuana, we can discover no significant doubt about Congress's purpose in prescribing the distribution of marijuana. While modifying that to this case, while the Nevada legislature, with the wisdom of hindsight, could have been more clear in its definition of marijuana metabolites, we can discover no significant doubt about the legislature's purpose in prescribing driving while having a certain level of marijuana or its metabolite in your blood. That is what is in the DUI statute. And incidentally, it's also in the other statute. Although the statute defines prohibited substances, it also lists several, including marijuana metabolites. So both statutes say that marijuana metabolites are a prohibited substance. This court even affirmed that somewhat in a subsequent decision after Williams involving employment law, where the court noted that marijuana metabolite was not a controlled substance, but it was a prohibited substance. Justice, there's nothing that's changed here. Same argument in 2002, same argument in 2004, same argument in 2016. The court's decision in 2002 and 2004 were correct. We would ask the court to affirm those decisions, to find that the lower court ruled correctly when it held that marijuana metabolites are a prohibited substance, and incorrectly when it found, based on a lack of ineffectiveness, that all the procedural bars were not in play. Unless the court has any further questions for me, that's all I have to say.
Well, I do have one. I'm not sure that the 2004 decision addressed the conflict in the two statutes adequately.
Well, that was the gist of the entire decision, was Mr. Watkins said, look, this statute, on the one hand, says prohibited substances have to be Schedule I or Schedule II. Then the second part of the statute lists marijuana metabolite as a prohibited substance. That's a general statute. The specific DUI statute said marijuana metabolite is a prohibited substance. Anyone who reads the DUI statute knows if I have above 5 nanograms of marijuana metabolite in my blood, I'm guilty. If I have 4 or below, I'm not. It's a very simple statute. I would submit to the court that the 2004 case is identical to the argument they're making here. What new argument are they making? Just as an aside, they say, you know, Mr. Watkins was ineffective because there's a conflict of interest. Well, what arguments are they making today that Watkins didn't make back in 2004? He was not ineffective.
What is your assessment of Judge Dawson's perception of the court's approach with regard to that statute?
Well, I believe Judge Dawson has erred in his decision. I'm going to have to quote my mother as authority. She told me when I was a young man, Bruce, simply because everybody else in town is jumping off a cliff doesn't mean you need to do so also. Judge Dawson, I believe, has incorrectly interpreted the Nevada statute. I don't know that he was aware of the Ohio case when he made his decision, but in any event, his error should not be compounded by having this court follow his decision. This court is not bound by his decision. This is a matter of state law. We will litigate, obviously, in federal court, once this court has made its decision, the propriety of his decision, both with him and subsequently, if need be, with the Ninth Circuit or the Supreme Court.
Well, in deciding this case, is it necessary for this court to point out if the court agreed with your view that the approach that Judge Dawson took and its defects?
Possibly. However, I think this court could also say that the procedural bars mandate dismissal of the case without ever getting to the underlying issue, because Mr. Watkins was not ineffective as a matter of law in his representation of Jessica Williams. Therefore, there is no excuse for failing to file this within a year and failing to file it within the first petition.
Well, I do think there is a concern advanced by appellant that in situations where there are conflicts, conflict-free counsel should be talking about ineffective assistance of claims.
And I don't necessarily disagree with that.
I mean, even the state requested different counsel on post-conviction.
And so I'm not disputing that. My point is simply there was no conflict here because there was no ineffectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with the court saying you were not ineffective, therefore we're not going to appoint conflict counsel. This court said in 2004, Mr. Watkins, this is not a valid argument.
Well, in any event, in answering the procedural bar, one has to answer it in the context of the merits.
Yes, but the procedural bar, I believe the court in 2004...
Well, you're answering the procedural bar by saying the merits don't justify the outcome, so he wasn't ineffective, so the fact that he was in conflict potentially doesn't matter.
Well, I'm saying that in 2004, in this court's decision deciding that the argument was not valid, the court in effect found he was not ineffective. There was no reason then to appoint counsel to determine whether he or not he was ineffective because the court's 2004 decision, at least by implication, addressed that issue, and that's why the court did not in 2004 subsequently appoint counsel.
You think
counsel.
That's a sufficient distinction to address the equal protection argument that Mr. Pichetta makes?
Yes, because the statute in this case, the DUI statute, is very clear. It says if you have this substance in your blood at this level, you're guilty. To the extent it may conflict with the general statute, the special statute would control. Rules of statutory construction are permissible, as the Lugman case and the Walton case show, and do not violate equal protection or anything else when a court interprets a statute to be constitutional. And it's frankly a little ironic. The defense said, well, this court engaged in rank judicial legislation in 2004 when it found the statute to be valid. Now they're appearing before this court and asking you to engage in judicial legislation and find the statute invalid. Apparently it's only rank judicial discrimination or legislation when it's against you. If it's for you, then I guess it's judicial activism.
So do we have to overrule our 2004 decision in order to give the appellant the relief that he seeks?
I believe you would, Your Honor. Because the 2004 decision plainly said this statute is plain on its face, marijuana metabolites are included within the statute, and therefore the fact that there was a general verdict doesn't matter because the defendant was guilty under either marijuana or marijuana metabolite. And as an aside, the only way she can get a marijuana metabolite in her blood is to use marijuana. Marijuana metabolite in and of itself is not sold and is not used because it's in the form of blood or urine, and people don't smoke or drink blood or urine.
Well, on that educational note, Mr. Nelson, we'll let you conclude your argument.
Thank you, Justices.
Mr. Pichetta.
Most of what Mr. Nelson has just said is entirely irrelevant to the question that is before this court. We're not disputing that other courts conduct statutory construction analysis. We are saying, although we are not happy about what this court decided in Williams 2, it did a statutory construction analysis. What it did not do was a vagueness analysis. What it did not do was an analysis of having two definitions of marijuana metabolite, one of which says the defendant is guilty, and one of which says the defendant is not guilty. That is a different question. If you look at this court's jurisprudence on statutory construction, you say in many cases, in McKay and many previous cases, we try to discern the intent of the legislature, even if it conflicts with the actual meaning of the words in the statutes. As a theory of statutory construction, that is permissible up to a point. As a theory of notice under the due process clause, that is not permissible. Because what you have now is still the same thing that you had before, but the argument is different. The argument is not that as a statutory construction matter, you should overrule Williams 2. Our argument is, if we assume that this court has defined state law, which it has the right to do, and its word on that is final, that given that, you still have not yet answered the question, all right, a person of ordinary intelligence seeing two statutes, one of which says you're guilty, and one of which says you are not guilty, can coexist in this statutory scheme and provide notice of what it is that is forbidden and what it is that is not forbidden. Thank you.
Mr. Pichetta, Mr. Nelson, we appreciate your arguments and your briefs on this matter, and this case will stand submitted. Thank you very much.